Managing Violence Podcast, episode 84, with Marine Corps and LAPD veteran Mark Morales. We're going to be talking all things law enforcement, stress management, critical incidents, control and restraint. It's going to be a lot of stuff going on. Mark's a great guy. You're going to enjoy this episode. Check it out. Managing Violence Podcast is proud to be partnered with Fuji Sports. Fuji Sports manufactures the highest quality of judo, jiu-jitsu, and MMA gear. Everything from gis to rashis, shorts, gloves, pads, bags, mats, finger tape, everything you could possibly need for training. I've personally been a customer and supporter of Fuji Sports dating back to my very first BJJ gi in 2007. Since then, they've been a go-to brand for me, whether I was chasing judo gear, BJJ gear, MMA gear, or just convenient bags to carry everything around in. The gi I wear to Krav Maga training now is actually a Fuji Sakai. It's one of the most comfortable and most durable gis I've ever owned. And yes, they even come in black for the ninjas in the audience. As a listener of the show, simply enter the discount code MVP10 at checkout for 10% off your order, and a percentage of the sale will also go to the show to keep us on the air. Savings for you, commission for us. What's not to love about that? MVP10 for 10% off at fujisports.com or fujisports.com.au for the Aussies. Some exclusions apply. Thank you, Fuji Sports, for years of high-quality gear and for supporting the show. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Managing Violence Podcast. We're back from our brief break. I want to say a heartfelt thank you to everyone who sent messages of support over the past couple of weeks. As long-term listeners will know, I had a tragedy in the family and had to take some time away to manage that and get everyone strong and healthy and moving on with our lives. And it's great to be back having these interviews and having the podcast up and running again. So we'll be back to regular schedule from this point forward. And today I am joined by the first in the series of law enforcement guests. Our guest today is Mark Morales. Mark may not be someone that you have heard of before. He has deliberately kept a low profile over the years, but within the industry, he is known. He is a former elite level wrestler. He is a judo black belt. He's a third degree Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt under Jean-Jacques Machado. But for the purposes of managing violence, he is also a Marine Corps veteran and then a 28-year veteran of the LAPD, where he received 3 medals for valor, was involved in 5 shooting incidents, and certainly has the runs on the board or the credibility when it comes to be able to manage high stress situations. Mark's also an expert teacher and use of force trainer. So he has a lot of insights that could be useful for all of us in all walks of life, not just for our law enforcement listeners. I had a great time talking to Mark. We have a lot in common, which is a lot of our opinions were similar, and we had a great time riffing back and forth. Mark also bought my book and read my book, so it's unusual for a guest to plug my book during the podcast, but hey, I'll take it. All right, folks, I'm not going to ramble too much. Please support our sponsors. Please join our Patreon if you want bonus content from this episode and every other episode. And if you don't want to do that, then just buy me a coffee, buymeacoffee.com/JoeMVP or patreon.com/managingviolence. All right, here we go. Here is the one and only Mark Morales. I'm joined here on the Managing Violence Podcast by Mark Morales. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Hey, glad to be here.
It's fantastic to have you on the show, Mark. You reached out a little while ago, and when I started reading your bio, I was like, this is a dude I've got to have on the show. I mean, your bio, I won't go into all the details, but your bio really does read like an 80s action movie, starting off in the Marine Corps, the LAPD, 28 years of service there. Involved in 5 shootings, 3 medals of valor, highly decorated police officer, left start your own company. You competed at an elite level in wrestling. You got a judo black belt. You're a third degree black belt under Jean-Jacques Machado. There's a lot on the lot of meat on the bone there, and it's a crying shame, as we've talked before, just before we went live, that more people don't know who you are. So it's fantastic to have this conversation. I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, it's okay, because I'm a public service guy coming off. I just retired 3 years ago from the police department, and I'm busy in the private security industry. And as you know, this week with the Chauvin trial wrapping up, everything's ramping up here. But when I saw your podcast, it really, and I'm not a type of person that normally would reach out, but I just thought it was the best subject matter podcast out there that dealt with a lot of, I guess a lot of books and past writings and things like Lawrence Kane, Lauren Christensen, Chris Wilder, that, you know, that whole group that had been doing writing, and not to leave anyone out, but Meditations on Violence book, and this genre started out, and I would say I was one of like the outliner type authors. Lauren Christensen invited me to do some writing projects, and I took them up, and then I got back busy with policing for the next 10 years. And so I just kind of been like scouting from the outside. But at the end of the day, I've combined work experience, martial arts training, and education with, the study of violence. And even though I never met you, I feel very connected on parallels. You know, maybe we can talk about it, but I read your book, and the parts about judo and the parts about boredom, like when you're at the Tiffany store, right? And so I just, you know, it resonated so true to me. So even though we're sitting here, we've never met, I feel like I've known you for 20 years.
Oh, it's very kind of you to say. And it's unusual that a guest plugs my book before we get started, but I'll take it. Thank you.
Yeah.
So Mark, let's just start at the beginning. For those that know nothing about you other than the 30-second snapshot I just provided, I'm really intrigued because, the journey from military service with the Marines through to the LAPD, I won't say it's the normal transition, but it's not an abnormal transition. I'm curious about where when you started wrestling and judo and Brazilian jiu-jitsu, talk us through that martial arts journey. And was that as a result of the service and wanting to upskill, or was it something you always did?
No. So when I was a little kid, you hear this so repeated, and it makes me think of Bass Rutten's story. Like, I was a small kid, and bullies and having to take alternative routes home from school, and kids, you know, when kids are like 2 to 3 years older, you're a grade or two, three ahead. I mean, those odds are magnificent at that time. Things tend to even, and I wouldn't be lying if I said I didn't settle some of those scores when we were all grown up. But I was a product of bullies. And so my dad, when I was 10 years old, and I always tell this story, is that I wanted to do karate. I always tell the story too, that I first went to a book fair and, in school, part of like the school, after school program. And I picked up a book about Bruce Lee. I still have that book. And, I fell in love with the martial arts. I'm 54 years old, so I'm a product of like the 70s and 80s. But my parents didn't have money, so they took me to the YMCA, and I didn't really think it was a good idea because I wanted to do karate. But boy, years later, how smart my dad was. I started in judo and wrestling. And so I would say, like a wrestler, and America has excellent wrestling, and I was definitely got to do a lot of cool stuff in wrestling. But I wasn't the greatest wrestler, but I did have some opportunities. And in 1986 and 87, I ended up at the University of Iowa as a walk-on. And I had been there wrestling the summer before. And I met a family, wonderful family, the Bravermans. And they ended up getting me into school. And I ended up, more practicing with the team, as I had some academic eligibility issues. So I got in under a different type of program. But I spent a year before I joined the Marine Corps with Dan Gable and that whole lineup of 80s dynasty. Shout out to Harlan and Marty Kistler that really took me under my wings. Another guy I haven't talked to, a guy named Eric Hennigan, who was in the room with me. And so I met so many amazing people. And one of the highlights is for like 2 weeks or 3 weeks in the summer, one summer, I was about 160 pounds at the time. And I worked out in a group. Literally, there were three of us. Dan Gable was 36 at the time. And I was about the right size. So Harlan Kistler, who's an All-American Olympic alternate, was in law school at the time. And the three of us worked out like, you know, like top bottom out, one guy in. And so that was incredible because Dan Gable was already an icon by then. But now when I look back at it 30 years later and say, hey, look, how many guys actually got to work out and wrestle in a group? And the man was intense still at that time. How many people got to do that? Well, anyway, after a year, I didn't get bad grades. I was about C's then, but I had not prepared myself to go to college. I was a very mediocre, below average athlete that had an opportunity because of a wrestling tournament. I wasn't recruited to Iowa or anything like that. I just ended up going to school there and taking advantage of the circumstance. I joined the Marine Corps and I was in the infantry, and I had family members that, you know, I'd served in World War II and whatnot. I always felt that obligation tugging. I was a little conflicted when I started to go to college because I always wanted to join the military, and I ended up joining the Marines. And so when I saw your podcast, I was actually in Platoon 2019 with Ken Shamrock. And so Ken in his book talks about being in the Marines for a little while. And let me tell you, man, this guy, it was before he was fighting or anything. He was a football player, and this guy was a specimen. I mean, if the way I recall it, he was about 220 pounds, about 6 feet tall, could run a sub 6 minute mile. And he, you know, could just physically do astronomical amount of pull-ups and whatnot. So he was definitely like a phenom then. Then I remember years later, turning on the UFC. I was already on the police department, like 4 years into my police career. And this guy was like, hey, there's this thing, the UFC. And I look at, and I'm like, man, Ken Shamrock, man, there's like, that even looks like the Shamrock and that I went through basic training with, and like, it has to be him. Anyway, I ended up talking to Ken years later, but in boot camp one day, the MPs came in. And there was a scramble. They took him out, and I never saw him again. And what I had learned is there was some trouble. He, you know, as he disclosed, he broke his neck. And I'll tell you, man, like, they could have set that dude alone loose on Iraq, and like, he would have handled the problem. This dude, when they say like he's the world's most dangerous man, this is true. And I'll tell you a funny story. I just told this to my students the other day. We were at Ensign Range at Camp Pendleton, where they do the firearms training for rifle in basic training. And so Staff Sergeant Branch, I won't ever forget this guy. He was our senior drill instructor. He takes us out back of the squad bay. And I'm looking like across just like, you know, the platoon, 50, 60 guys. I don't remember how many, but I'm looking at Ken Shamrock. And I remember exactly what we're wearing. We were wearing like our green skivvies, undershirts and camis. And I think some guys were wearing some white ones because we're doing like KP duty. We'd finish. And the sergeant takes off, Sergeant Brantz takes off his blouse, and he puts it to the side. And he's like, I don't know if it was scripted or, you know, this is week 8 where we do this. But he's like, you MFers, I will fight each and every one of you. Like, who wants some? Step up here. And I have to think years later when Sergeant Branch watched the UFC and everything that Ken Shamrock did, that he thanked his lucky stars. And he was like, my God, Ken Shamrock never took me up on my offer back in Camp Pendleton. So true story. True story.
That's incredible. We could have a full podcast about the famous people that you've brushed up against or worked with and so on. It's quite interesting to see how many former guests really show that you've had connections with, whether it's working with them, authoring books with them, reviewing their work, or going to boot camp with Ken Shamrock. It's incredible how interconnected these worlds can be
Richard Norton, your guest Richard Norton, you know, he and I have, you know, hung out and trained at, you know, the Machado Academy and had lunch together on several occasions. We have several, the guy he's talking to you about, Lou Salcedo, who you keep referring to about his statistics. Mm. He's a good friend of mine, served in LAPD with him. So it, you know, it's a small world, you know what I mean? It's a small world.
Absolutely. So let's talk about your career.
You had a very distinguished career with in the LAPD, and received the Medal of Valor 3 times. So you've been through some pretty say interesting experiences when it comes to a career of service over a number of years. If my research is correct, you're sort of at the epicenter of the Rodney King riots.
Yes.
You were dealing with that at that time and have been involved in 5 shootings throughout your career.
Yes.
What I'd really like to unpack with you, I mean, given your bona fides, we could talk a lot about Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu or about judo or about wrestling or about any of those things, but I'm particularly interested from a law enforcement angle because I think a lot of people don't understand the difference between what it means to defend yourself as a civilian and what it means to actually be hands-on on a regular basis as a law enforcement officer, and perhaps even given the length of your career, I mean how that evolved in the 80s and 90s through to the modern era where everything is filmed, everything is second guessed, everything is can be reviewed by uninformed witnesses or the general uninformed population after the fact and how the impact that can have on officers' stress levels. But let's just start at the beginning there. It would be remiss not to touch on the critical stress incidents that you're involved in. Can you talk us through what that exposure was like, the first time that you felt like this isn't just an arrest, this could actually be fatal, like this is actually life-threatening. Can you talk us through that first experience and what that had on you, how old you were, how experienced you were at that point?
For sure. So being in the military, I was in during peacetime and I got great training. And then on the police department, by choice, I think I spent all my time in uniform patrol. And I went away to some investigative assignments and worked undercover. I worked the gang unit, narcotics, but I always came back to patrol. And eventually I became a field training officer. And I just felt that, that was where the biggest impact could be for me on a day-to-day basis. And although I appreciate guys that go to work bomb squad and SWAT and all these other jobs that the public's very familiar with, from television and media and admire these positions, I was like the patrol guy. And so my job was showing up on unpredictable 911 calls. And so, LA, and we were talking beforehand, a lot of this seems like very, normal to me, but when I was listening to you talk to, is it Beverly from,
Beverly Becker from Asphalt Anthropology.
Yeah. And you were like, hey, the first time I went to LA, it was, it's like really big and, it's a violent city and it's true. And I'm inoculated to it because I'd been here so long, but it really is, it is a violent city. And so, there's been peaks and valleys and calmer parts with that, but daily, like across the world, everybody knows who Crips, Bloods, 18th Street, Serenos, all these gangsters in patrol or working a gang unit. I dealt with these type of individuals daily. And, out of interactions, not everything ended up violent, but certainly, everything occurs from the North Hollywood shootout to lesser tactical incidents, but things happen every day in Los Angeles. So the training when I went through the police academy in 1990 was really good. And I thought got it mentally ready. I mean, we had some legendary tactical instructors, people with a lot of experience. And so I thought when I hit the streets, they had us geared up for that. And so, I would say probably I was involved in, many incidents with, chasing armed guys, vehicle pursuits, like crazy stuff. But I would say like the first crazy thing that happened is when I was working the gang unit, the infamous LAPD crash unit, that the movie Colors with Sean Penn is predicated on. And so one night we were out patrolling and this gangster robbed 3 or 4 people at ATM. He ended up taking a woman hostage and we ended up getting in pursuit of this suspect. And the guy ended up skidding out at the freeway and a cross street. and you know, numerous officers showed up, and the guy had dropped his gun down on the floorboard, and we're kind of close up, and my partner, you know, I don't think it was the greatest tactical decision, but he decided to walk up and grab the guy to save the hostage. And when he tried to pull the guy out of the car, it was a stick shift, and the guy was grinding the gears, and he took off, and he hit a pole, turned my partner upside down, pinned him in the door, and started dragging him. And I was really the only position out of maybe like 10 officers to take a shot. So in order to, you know, to stop him where he was at, I shot him, and he ended up living and surviving. But, you know, that was the first time that I had to make a split second decision. And let me be honest with you, like when there's a hostage and a police officer is being drugged under a car and you shoot somebody and the gun's on the floorboard, you're going to have to answer a lot of questions. So that one, it ended up turning out okay, but there were, you know, several other tactical incidents that were, you know, where you have to make split second decisions under stress. Because literally, and this is what I would tell people when I was training them, I'd say, one minute you're laughing and you're joking, and the next minute, like, you know, you're in a gunfight, or somebody wearing the same uniform as you is laying dead on the ground, and you're showing up as a backup officer, and it's on. So, you know, after almost 30 years of sustained combat, you know, on the streets of Los Angeles, I can say that, you know, I learned a lot, and there's levels to it. So when you're teaching like a rookie off the street, he's not going to get like the upper levels of it. He's going to need some timing with it, you know, but I was always, at the wrong place at the right time, but I felt, you know, a duty and to help people. And, I never took a backward step. I practiced Bushido every day.
There's so much there that we could talk about. One of the things that I find really fascinating as a subject matter, I mean, we can talk about physical skills and marksmanship and all that kind of thing, which is important, but the ability to make a decision when the consequences for a decision are so high, and to not freeze and to not panic and to not hesitate and to not delay that, even, because I mean that decision, if you delay that by 1 second, has different ramifications. We get stuck in this OODA loop where we're continually trying to orientate, we're continually trying to make sense of the situation and not actually, you know, pardon the pun, but pulling the trigger and actually choosing an action and going for it.
Yes.
And I think sometimes when you look at this from a civilian angle, and myself included, I mean, if I was ever in a life and death situation now, like, the ramifications for me are completely different, because it's probably going to happen in my home. It's probably going to involve my kids. Like, the justification is super easy. But when you're just on the job and you literally are just trying to get to the end of your shift and go home and go to bed, and you know that decision to pull that trigger may be the end of your career if it's reviewed differently.
Yes.
How does that stress impact that decision making? I mean, it has to be automated to a degree, because you couldn't possibly process all the variables. But how do you get better at that over the time?
Well, what happens is you have to have a baseline for training, and a lot of it can be compared to martial arts training, right? So the day like an incident occurs, the time of training is over, but usually there's a lot of time beforehand where you're going to have time to train. And I think other guests have alluded to, it's interdisciplinary. So there's the mental process, there's the training process, there's the discussions and roll call, there's formal training, there's understanding the laws, right? So you have to understand like when a police officer can use force, which is very detailed, right? Then you have to, you know, in understanding the state, California State Penal Code, for instance, and then understanding your department's use of force policy with it, and which is usually more restrictive. And then the day the stars line up is that you just apply that training instinctively, and the tools that you use, such as like, you know, the fact simulator, you know, the simulated shooting and decisions making behind it. And then, you know, one of the things we were doing later in LAPD is we were running people through simulators. Then we'd say, well, why did you do that? Or this force option, or what? We create the student to think. And I'll be honest with you, early on, I was a big advocate of investing in my own training and studying. And I think it cognitively developed me into a better decision maker, and I never stopped learning. And so I got involved in some crazy capers on the police department, and what people would say about me is like, oh, he's a really good writer. He can write it up. Or, you know, he's a good talker, you know, he's articulate, you know? And so I think that's part of the game, is that you have to understand the rules of engagement, societal, and now even more so, you have to understand what public policy is, right? And so you get a lot of this on different fronts, but I understood the expectations of a peace officer to what societal expectations were, and then basically how to explain it. And so when you can explain it, you can act on it, in my opinion, right? And so one of the things about the Boyd cycle or the OODA loop is everyone can make an observation and they can orientate, but it's between decision and act where the big hiccup is. So I'll be honest with you, deciding and acting, and you know, it probably fits a psychological profile that they recruited for in maybe the 70s, the 80s, and then they changed after 2000 for the type of psychological profile, you know, that. And so when these critical incidents happen within the police department, they don't have maybe somebody that's the best equipped. Because when I got hired, they were hiring super aggressive people. And because we had super aggressive crime problems. And so I'll give you an example. So after about 3 months before I retired, we got a 911 call, and out on the street, domestic violence suspect and running gun battle. And I remember this dude was on. And so there were four of us bounding up the street. There were people, civilians running out of the way. And I literally got under like a fender of a car and a tire, and the guy was across the street shooting, and I had enough time to take cover. Man, I'll tell you, man, it sounded like Iraq. And I was like, I told myself, man, if I live through this one, you know, and there's been some close calls. If I live through this one, that's it. Because you know, the secret about riding the bull is you got to know when to get off the bull. And so anyway, we ended up engaging this guy, and that's the other thing too. Like, you know, there was no, you know, we're trying to stop this guy. And he came out gun blazing, and one of the rifle cadre guys put him down. But, you know, within, you know, the dynamics of those stressful situations, it was never a question like of what to do. And I was talking to a well-noted self-defense expert that I serve with on LAPD. And so, you know, we're talking about, you know, the hiring process and whatnot. And just to revert back to the original point is that every time you have a shooting and you're involved in a tactical incident, you go see the shrink. And so what I was telling him, a story is when I went to go see the shrink, and the shrink was like, hey, when are you going to retire? You know, they don't even have, they don't hire guys like you anymore, you know? And so, you know, there's a whole new mentality. And I said, hey, like, I'm aware of it. I see it all the time. And this is the advice that he gave me. He said, you know, people like dinosaurs, you know, kids, everybody likes a dinosaur. They like to see a dinosaur at the La Brea tar pits at the museum. They don't like to see a dinosaur running down Topanga Canyon Boulevard at 2 a.m. in the morning. You know what I mean? So,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, it's a, it is interesting. There's a whole evolution there, I guess, with what the public expect of their law enforcement officers and the protectors, and there's a lot we can unpack there. I mean, we've both both avid readers of Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman's work, and the sheepdog and the wolves. There's some interesting things to talk about there in terms of like what is the attitude of the sheep towards the sheepdog when the wolves don't seem to be a problem anymore, you know? Like, and then you get rid of the sheepdogs, and what happens? The wolves come back. So
wolves. But you know, I think does an excellent job, and who introduced me into writing is Lauren Christensen, because, like, I would say, Dave Grossman, his work's excellent, but it deals with police officers and it deals with military personnel. But Lauren really focused into the law enforcement like community. And, you know, like, for instance, like, I was in the police academy in the On Combat book when Stacey Lim was followed home from the police department and ambushed. And so, you know, I dealt with her, on and off in the police department, had many conversations with her over the years, or we had to go debrief some tactical incident. She was over at training tactics. And, Dave and Lauren did excellent job on that. But Lauren has so many books out there that talk about mindset and whatnot. And so he was one of the authors, like, when nothing else was out there. Before Rory put out Meditations on Violence, and then, you know, Lawrence Kane and Alan Bernice, all these authors came out kind of at the same time. But Lauren had been there a long time. I remember reading like a book the first book called, I think it was called Anything Goes. And it was like about using karate, like, you know, that he was honest. He said that his traditional karate had failed him. And so I think we're even still talking about those things today. But back to your like key point is, I think like what are, like wrestling and judo and doing tournaments, and I'm sure you understand this, man, it steeled me for other higher grade single combat like gunfighting, you know? And so nobody ever wants to get in a gunfight. They don't go out saying, and I hope you don't, that to say, hey, look, I'm out looking for this, and you know, that this happens. But as your duty, especially like in the top tier policing game of uniform patrol, you know, there's villains out there. And so sometimes the stars line up, and the police officer is the elected democratic official to deal with that at 2 a.m. in the morning in an alley back out somewhere. Maybe he has some backup and maybe he doesn't, but he's there to protect society. So that was my job for 28 years. And you have to prepare in many aspects. And so one of the things, LAPD has a big police memorial, and I knew guys, I had an academy classmate shot and killed in a foot pursuit. And I would, you know, when we go to our training where the memorial's at, I'd always look at that, and I'd know guys, and like, since when I was on the police department, I would say almost like 40 officers got killed in the line of duty. And so I'd look at that, and, and every one of them didn't plan to get killed the day they went to work. And so you have to, you know, you got to make sure in every way and to stay safe, but yet stay psychologically normal, like not to be so paranoid. Right. I agree. Like in your last podcast, when you and Beverly were talking about people going to be on alert, like you can practice all this, but like, what's really your environment? A police officer, when comes on the scene, everybody's got to feel safer. And so you have to be reading people's body language, looking at the threats and whatnot, while appearing to be normal and friendly, you know, because that's what, you know, it calls for. People call the police, they need help. You know, they don't want to deal with a robot or somebody that doesn't have people skills, you know? And so you got to have tremendous people skills and be able to, at the drop of a hat, you know, switch that gear and take someone's life if you have to. And hopefully that doesn't happen, but it does happen.
Yeah, it's such a remarkably complex profession. And I don't think that anyone, if you don't personally know a law enforcement officer, you can't really fully appreciate just how complex and stressful that job can be. Obviously, different jurisdictions have different stresses, and there's different realities. I mean, you can go 30 years and never have a and never have a life-threatening situation, or you may have one every Tuesday. Like it really depends on where you serve. And one thing I'd love to unpack with you, given your grappling pedigree, the fact that you've been a police trainer. So, again, just to rehash, you competed at an elite level in wrestling, you're a judo black belt, you're a third degree black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu under Jean-Jacques Machado. I think one of the biggest gaps that I've observed, not just in law enforcement, but in security and anywhere we have to apprehend people, is the quality of education when it comes to how to actually restrain someone using a minimum level of force. And as you know from listening to the other podcasts and you've read my book, which is really nice, but I mean, working within different environments where there's no authority. And a lot of we didn't have an authority. A lot of the time we're completely unarmed. There's no or else to go to when it comes to trying to get someone to comply with something. Our legal obligation or legal powers are limited. And then working in a mental health institution or a mental health environment, as an example, where these are not bad people, they're unwell people. So you don't want to do harm if you can avoid it. But a lot of people do harm because they just don't have the skills to be able to control that situation peacefully or safely. And I'm reminded of something that Damian Maia said in an interview after a UFC fight, where he said, the goal of jiu-jitsu is to win the fight without harming your opponent. And I love that, because that was always kind of my mentality. Well, it wasn't always my mentality, but it was my mentality eventually, was how do I control this with no one having to write an incident report, basically.
Right.
So what I want to get to, it's a long-winded way of introducing a question, but we've had a lot of conversation over the last, I guess especially the last 3 to 4 years, about whether there needs to be mandatory Brazilian jiu-jitsu in law enforcement. We had Luis Gutierrez on last year, I think, chatting about his opinion as a BJJ black belt himself and law enforcement trainer. He says that he doesn't think that BJJ is the answer, more there should be a systemized version that gets taught to law enforcement. Where do you stand on the grappling education of police, knowing the practicalities and the realities of budget and training time and all that kind of thing? What do you think is the answer to try and upskill our peace officers to be able to handle these situations?
Well, in LAPD, they have what's called arrest and control, the ARCON self-defense unit. The guys do a good job of, 40 to 80 hours of training with updated. But as you know, like any training, that's not enough. So I got interviewed by Black Rifle Coffee, the Coffee or Die magazine. And I talked about that. And the main point is two things. You don't have to embrace the whole jiu-jitsu curriculum. What you have to do is you have to learn how to hand fight. And so I think one of the things that we got in judo and higher levels of judo that the public and the martial arts public doesn't understand, because judo is a little fringe to MMA, is the gripping game. And so when you're a good gripper, you're a good hand fighter. And so when we're talking about handcuffing transitions, we're talking about hand and wrist control and from the elbow control, right? So I think in the law enforcement approach, you have to take a person prone and put their hands behind their back, look at it as a subject matter and say, how do we get here in the safest manner possible? And then what I've done is reverse engineer techniques, right? And so believe it or not, I tell this story with my students. When I came on the police department, it was all about hit people with the baton as many times as possible to make them submit. We know how that worked out, right? It didn't work out well. And what happens is, if you really think about it, it was too effective of a technique, right? Just like grabbing someone, taking them down and punching them in the face 15 times. It's effective. It's too effective, right? And so what we expect our peace officers and people protect us to use force, but the law requires to use the least amount of force within there. Obviously, if somebody's grabbing your gun, the force is going to be more extreme than somebody that you're doing a come along technique and they begin to pull away from you. But I couldn't believe it when I started the police academy that they were coming out of wrestling and not just freestyle wrestling. My thing was, I think, better geared for self-defense, because I was a Greco-Roman wrestler. holds above the waist. And what happened is if you're an average college wrestler and you were not like a great freestyle wrestler where America is really strong, if you wanted to try to get some international experience or make an Olympic team, all the guys that weren't too good, like they weren't going to beat the Dave Schultz or the reigning world-class Kenny Mondays and John Smiths, they went to Greco. And that's what I did. And then what we found out in mixed martial arts is that Greco, because of the upright position, was better suited for mixed martial arts in a lot of ways because it dealt with pummeling and infighting and whatnot. And that was actually the subject of a book that I wrote with Lauren Christensen called Fighting in the Clinch. But a lot of those techniques I ended up utilizing and teaching to other police officers about not even like the takedowns with it, but the control, like the 2-on-1 series, arm drag, wrist control. And what happens is like in defensive tactics training, there's all like this macro level. Like I'll give you an example of what I believe to be failed training, right? You put the fist suit, right? Formerly known as like the red man and these type of suits on, all you're doing is you're teaching the officer impact, impact, impact. But there's no grappling with that. So I have a friend on the LAPD that's a training partner. A guy fought in the UFC, Phil Miller, 16-0. I had a contract dispute, became a cop. He's got to have between 50 and 20 years on now. But this guy, legit MMA fighter, and we were talking about like how to do this better. And what he said, man, like this fist suit is bad news because we're just teaching them how to hit people. And it's too effective, right? Guy's got a black eye, as you allude to, in Neon Jungle. Cameras are everywhere. And it's always like the old who threw the second punch. And now you're being questioned on it. But with what we did is we put our students in gis. And then we, you know, the gi in jiu-jitsu, you know, we weren't teaching them jiu-jitsu techniques, but it gave them a tool to hang on to. So they'd hang on to the gi and be in different positions. And we do like 2-on-1 arrests with the suspect and they take the suspect down. And then if they were out of position, we'd reposition them. And we learned that from doing reverse engineering. And we got these officers who had no grappling experience into grappling periods. And so this is how we would do it. Okay. We'd set up a tactical scenario. They'd approach, they'd be in the FI stance, L configuration. And then we'd say, they'd come up to handcuff the suspect. When they touch them, the suspect would start resisting at various explosive dynamics. And that's where the use of force, if you go back to Greg Dossey's 1994, I believe, study, which revolutionized the police training, bringing, you know, grappling and defensive tactics in into the modern after Rodney King, is that's where the great majority of arrests ended up taking place, was in the transition to handcuffing in the standing position. The problem was the officers were inconsistent in what they were being trained. And this is what happens. And I'm sure this happened when you were working the doors. One guy's pulling them to stand up. One guy's pulling them to pull down. The other guy's pulling them to the left. The other person's pulling them to the right. And what you have is you have four people fighting each other instead of having a coordinated takedown effort that they've all been trained on. So in defensive tactics training, not only do you have to train the single techniques, but you have to train like team swarm, team takedown, team handcuffing, right? And everybody's got to be moving on the same page. Some law enforcement agents do that, agencies do that, others do not. But there's another factor, and you alluded to it. There's workman's compensation injuries, people going off work for a long period of time. But I will tell you this, like built into that, like it's going to be far worse. You'll be far better off doing the practice and you will have injuries and you have to build that into your budget and whatnot. What's far worse is you have officers not trained and them having an incident where there's a perception and your city gets burned down and then it gets burned down again. And then 10 other cities get burned down. It's better to invest and just go, hey, we're building. We know officers are going to get hurt doing this, but we're going to do this. We have to get out of that mindset. And then we have to get back to a hiring where officers aren't afraid to get some bumps and bruises and come back to work and not say, it's a mentality that will carry you through to say, you know what, I'm hurt, but I'm coming back because I care about, you know, what I do, and not go, hey, I picked up my bag, I hurt my back, and I'm going to be off work for 6 months, and then I'll come back and pick up my bag again and be gone for a year. That's honest. That happens, and that's where we're at.
Yeah. I think the confidence level that comes with the ability to manage a situation unarmed, safely, not just for you, but for the subject, and also having confidence that what you're doing is going to look okay, because I mean we can do things that we know are safe, but the virtue of the fact that it's being recorded and an uninformed public are going to pass judgment on what we're doing. For as an example, I mean, so using something like a rear naked choke or any kind of strangulation, most of the time that's going to be safe. We know there's risk factors. We know that it can, depending on various health issues and so on, it isn't always a safe technique, but compared to putting holes in someone, it's not a bad option. But to the public, it looks very aggressive. It looks like you're trying to kill them. So sometimes our technique selection needs to be vetted through the lens of how does this look, not just whether it's effective, not just whether it's keeping me safe and keeping the subject safe, but what's the court of public opinion going to say? And I'd like to get your opinion, and feel free to artfully avoid the question if it's too sensitive, but you were involved in the Rodney King riots. You saw the aftermath of that. It feels look, I'm in Australia. I'm watching the media report. So the feeling on the ground may be different, but it looks very similar to what we've seen the last 12 months with George Floyd in terms of, but on a larger scale now, because obviously the information spreads and it's easy to stir up a movement. Do you think there was opportunities for lessons to be learned that weren't learned? Or do you think it was a storm in a teacup?
Well, for sure. And since the jury, they just had resting arguments today in the Chauvin trial, I will not comment till the trial is sure. done. Cause I certainly want, there's the court of public opinion and there's the facts, but I'll say this. So, there's similarities and I just think, and the point that I bring home, because we could give very polarizing opinions, say as a police officer, this and the, and as a community member, this. And I'll give you an example. I was down doing some work in Hollywood and I had a subunit come drive by and shine the lights in my eyes. And I don't know if he was looking something, but I kind of thought it was a douche move. I was standing outside of my car and so I see how sometimes the public, can get offended, by actions that police officers take, but sometimes they don't know the whole opinion. I mean, the whole process or procedure or what's going on, right? So they're only getting but perception's real, right? And they talk about you're talking about heuristics and one of the things I bring up and implicit bias training and trainings that you get is that stereotypes are stereotypes because there's some truth in stereotypes. That's why they become stereotypes. Same thing in police training. You have to realize that there's a perception out there and it's not always good, and invest in your training and teaching so you can lessen the impact. One of the things that John Jock Machado, my Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu master, he says, the more that you know, the less that you'll use. So police officers, if they don't have the right training, they either overreact or they underreact. Underreaction can be deadly to you and to the public. Overreacting can get you in a lot of trouble, both administratively and criminally. The need for training on the tactical level is so important because you need to employ the right tools and the right mindset to the right situation to resolve the problem and get off to the next problem that's going to be arising. I believe that with a better emphasis in training, we could get there. And I'll give you an example of how sometimes that training is meant to be well. but it doesn't hit the point. So one of the kind of trends we went through at LAPD is they wanted better customer service. So they involved a psychologist who you could tell that had never been a police officer. And so they started talking about treat everybody like their clients, like Nordstrom's. And they were like, they actually use the Nordstrom's, like, you know, when people come to Nordstrom's, they get what they want. And you can bring anything back at any time. It's the concierge service and whatnot. What doesn't work with that is that when you ask them, they say everyone's a client. So a child molester is a client. Yes, a child molester is a client. And so some dude that hits an old lady in the head with a crowbar is a client. Yes. See, that misses the mark, because when people go to Nordstrom's, they're getting what they want. They're not being taken to jail and having their freedom taken from them in the administration of justice, right? Sometimes approaching what goes on in policing and law enforcement is an ugly subject matter. And so I think for a long time, the situation was dealt with and the public didn't see what a gnarly job it can be. There were no cameras coming out or anything. And then now they're seeing it and they're constantly complaining about it. So the reaction from politics is to water it down, make it more approachable. But at the end of the day, the officers are less safe and society is less safe. And so this is a very interesting time with the advent of the camera on YouTube. And you allude to that in your book. You did a good job about that. With that, it resonated with me. Where is it going? Well, I don't know, because years ago they would say the pendulum swings back and forth, but the pendulum in law enforcement and deifying police has swung so far one way, it hasn't come back. So as a society, we're going to have to decide if we're going to be tolerant of antisocial people and behavior, or if we're going to be a society in a world, and I mean this across because the world's very connected today, if we're going to be a society that enforces the law and backs our police officers. And in that, there has to be a budget and training and realism, not the Nordstrom approach, but the realistic approach that, hey, good cops have always treated people right, right? You know, they're good people. They treat people right. And when somebody's not, you know, needs to be arrested, or they're resisting arrest, or they're doing something, the police will get involved and they will use the appropriate tactics and action to neutralize that problem, whether it's putting someone down or dealing with an active shooter. You know, I'll tell you, Joe, I have seen regular cops do the most incredible, bravest things. And they're only doing it because they understand universally what's right and wrong. And so I'm so proud that I served with these people that were not, they weren't fast, they weren't superhuman. But when they were out on that thin blue line, they said, this isn't happening on my watch, not tonight. And that's the one thing that resonates with me of working with the street, is that I work with so many unselfish, brave men and women. And I feel very special because these people still reach out with me with texting and like, hey, you know, this is what's going on. And, you know, they're trying to do a job, but, you know, all you have to do is turn on the television or view social media and you can see what's going on.
Yeah. Just to bring that section to a close, but something you mentioned there about the pendulum swing, and I don't think we want it to go back all the other way. We don't want to have a complete knee-jerk reaction to this, because we end up with, we know that we have had bad officers that have done bad things, and we know that's a real problem. We don't want to have a knee-jerk reaction to the current climate. But something I heard Jocko Willink talk about a couple of years ago was the need for an education class on how to deal with police, like how to actually interact with police, how to respond if you get pulled over, how to understand what a police officer's job may be like, or what that shift may have been like before that interaction. And I think we have a big push for empathy and compassion from the officer's point of view towards the people they're dealing with. Sometimes we forget that police officers are human beings and we need to have compassion for them as well. And about what their week or their month or their year has been like before that traffic stop, or before before they shine the light in your eyes, because they were looking for something in particular and they didn't think about how their actions were going to look to you. And I think we miss that common humanity too often. And we don't, most of us don't go to work knowing there's a chance we'll be shot, right? Most of us don't know that every customer we serve may pull a knife on us. So the level of stress that comes with that kind of job, I think the general public miss that. And the only interaction they have with police is either when they're doing something wrong or they're perceived to be doing something wrong. So therefore it's a negative interaction. When they need help, in which case it's already a really bad day for them. Or alternatively, when they jump on social media and they see something that is trending, that is inevitably an anomaly because it's trending. And I think the answer has to be some sort of somewhere in the middle of an education for the general public. And I know it would be, I saw a meme just over a copied and pasted post that went around a little bit the last couple of days about, you know, we should just be releasing every body worn camera footage of everything the police deal with the dog that's been tied to a tree and set on fire, or the child that's been brutally abused and so on. And it's like, well, you can't do that. You can't release all that because obviously, it's unethical. But if the public had a greater appreciation of what the other jobs will look like, they may have a little bit of understanding about what happens when a police officer maybe is perceived to be overreacting.
I actually think most of the community deals very well with the police and has a utmost respect for the police. And I agree, even the harder the neighborhood gets, the working people that appreciate the police presence in their neighborhood are very supportive. I will be honest with you. The only people that I ever had problems with and giving direction, lawful direction, are people that had, they were antisocial. And so that doesn't make up one sociological group or race or ethnicity. Some people are antisocial. And so that's like how I like to define it. I'm not sure that the goals of the criminal justice system or teaching somebody how to deal with the police, if they're antisocial, is going to correct that. The issues are deeper. And so when I look at gangs, for instance, I remember talking to this gang member. They had had a couple guys shot and killed by a security guard, and they were revenging by infecting a street tax. And so I stopped a couple of them late at night that were harassing this store where this had happened. And they tried to play the victim game with me. And I asked them, I said, are you the same gang I was reading about in the Los Angeles Times as being, the FBI's one of the top 10 gangs in Los Angeles? Or did you guys turn into a advocates group? Are you gang members, or are you taking a new approach to that? And I think today, one of the things, and I'll put it in a little story that somebody once told me. They said, hey, you ever see these crooks that write books and they try to convince you that they reformed? And I was like, I've read a few. And he goes, the trick in that as a cop is to spot the page where they try to trick you. And so I read a few books, and in every single one of them, the guy was, he tries to turn the tables and tell you that he reformed, right? So the night I was out there with those guys, they're basically telling me enforcing a street tax is, helping them and helping out the cause of their gang in so many words, but they know all the buzzwords, when reality, what they're doing is called extortion. So I think, like, in our society, what we have to be very careful with is, if we have laws and methods to deal with criminality, it's not a good thing to back down from criminality, right? So we have to decide, our political people have to decide where they're going to be on the issue of being tolerant of crime. And, is it okay to let people vent and burn down buildings? I don't think so. But we've heard those comments here in the United States. We've heard that say, just, and I've been there in those briefings where you know, we had the First Amendment here in protest, but where does that line get drawn? Well, I think we're very liberal today with that line being drawn, and it affects everything across the board. So definitely, like, you know, there's always been good cops and there's always been bad cops. And you can say that, you know, soldiers and, you know, people that in government, because like you said, they're human. But at some point as a society, we have to decide where we're going to be at. And we know that our police as tools in the toolbox are going to be able to use manage violence, state approved use of force violence. And that's really what we're talking about on this podcast, is that, are they going to be backed, you know, in that situation? And that's not even to talk about anything political that's going on now, but we have to accomplish that through training, and everybody understands what the training is. I'm for a nationalized training on use of force and whatnot, just like they've done with weapons of mass destruction and all these other terrorists. You know, they got a bunch of old coppers, retired guys together, and they start going through the curriculum. And I think definitely with the the United States Supreme Court cases that outline force, that we can definitely get a national standard together. And I know LAPD has been on the forefront. One of the things about the LAPD is they have so many incidents that end peacefully as opposed to violently. But when you're dealing in thousands of incidents and whatnot, some things are going to go awry.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we're coming up on time on the main interview, but before we close, I would like to give an opportunity, and we've talked a lot about your career and about what you've accomplished, but you left the LAPD a number of years ago and you started your own company. I know you're doing some training, you've got an academy. I just want to give you an opportunity to tell us a little bit about what you're doing now and what the future looks like, rather than looking back.
Well, I work in a high-risk security, so a lot of that is of the confidential nature, but we deal with international security issues here in Los Angeles and above. And I do a lot of consulting in that area. My martial arts academy is it's a John Jock Machado affiliate. It's about 20 miles outside of Los Angeles in Ventura County, Simi Valley to be exact. And I would just say that I'm surrounded by the most amazing men and women out there. And I was a person that I always wanted my own academy. And what happened was I got the opportunity about 5 years to do it. And I was in graduate school at the time, finishing my master's degree, but the opportunity came available to get the academy. So I did it early. And I just am surrounded by the most amazing people. And so, like in Ventura County, a lot of police and fire live out there. So I have a great group of public safety people. So rather than plugging a book or a service or something, I want to give a shout out to some of the people that made that possible. My partner, Bryce Eddy, one of my top instructors there, Todd Johnson, Rick Petrie, and others. A lot of students that have really come in and helped out. So I'm sure I didn't hit everyone, Jamie Walsh and Scott Young, black belts from the Machado company that come over there. And of course, John Jock Machado and his right-hand man, Jay Zabalos, and his brother, Mike. Thank you all, because I would not be the person or be sitting here today to share these stories, because I think my jiu-jitsu training, in addition to my wrestling and judo, I believe are in a interdisciplinary perspective of allowed me to survive 3 decades of policing on some of America's most violent streets.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been incredible to talk to you, Mark. I'm going to ask you to stick around and do some bonus questions with us shortly. But for those that might be leaving us here, I just want to express my sincere gratitude for making yourself available. I know you're a busy man, but it's so valuable to sit under the learning tree from someone who's been there, done that over an extended period of time, and has really thought
long and hard about the lessons that are there to be learned, and trying to impart those on others. So I appreciate you for what you're doing and for being.
I'll just say, Joe, I'm not a perfect person. I'm a human being like everyone else. But if I'm gonna leave the listeners and viewers with one request, is use your martial arts to become a better person, because it will happen. That's the paradox of training in combat. If you're under the right instruction, it will make you a more empathetic person, a more person that expresses the right values, and then use that position and platform to help other people. That could be through training. It could be through random acts of kindness. But I think, Joe, that you and your podcast have really, you've taken your life experiences and you are leading the way for many of us to practice that and giving us an opportunity to tell our story. So thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you very much, Mark. And the hashtag for the show is #ForTheProtectors. And that's what the show is for. It's not just for the law enforcement officers or the bodyguards or whoever, but it's for everyone who has the desire to protect others, to protect themselves, protect their loved ones, and to make humanity better. For me, martial arts has always been my avenue for being able to protect the vulnerable. And I hope that others that have a similar calling get value out of it. So thank you very much for your time and also for the kind words.
Man, what a great conversation that was with Mark. He has a wealth of knowledge, a wealth of experience, and just a really humble martial artist and servant. And it was great to have that chat. Next week, I'm going to be joined by Jeff Quayle, who is a co-author of a new book called A Scientific Approach to Reality-Based Training. And we'll be talking about how to do scenario-based training realistically, responsibly, and to actually make our students better, as opposed to just scaring the hell out of them, which is what a lot of people do with scenario-based training. That's a great conversation. You're going to enjoy it. Until then, I'll talk to you next time.